Hello, and thank you for joining us for Research in Progress at Shawnee State University, brought to you by the Teaching and Learning Center, located in Clark Memorial Library in beautiful Southern Ohio. On this podcast, we celebrate faculty achievement and highlight their current projects. We want to know what fuels their passion for research and education. What do higher education professionals spend their lives learning about? Find out in today's episode. A long time ago, in galaxies far away, there were quasars. These quasars emitted bright light that traveled in all directions. And now, after traveling for billions of years, that light is visible from right here on Earth. The astronomers and physicists who study quasars can quite literally look back in time to study the formation and evolution of galaxies. Today on Research in Progress, we'll hear from one of these astronomers and learn more about his work on quasars and black holes. Welcome, everyone, to the very first episode of Research in Progress at Shawnee State University. I'm Dr. Jen Scott, Associate Professor of English and Humanities. My guest today is Dr. Timothy Hamilton, who's a professor of astronomy and physics here at Shawnee State. He graduated with a doctorate from the University of Pittsburgh and conducted research at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which operates the famous Hubble Telescope, before he joined Shawnee State. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hamilton.
Thank you, Jen.
To start us off, can you tell us a little bit about your position here at Shawnee, what you teach and what you do outside of your teaching?
Okay, so I'm one of two physics professors that we have. I'm a full professor now, I guess for the last few years. I'm also the coordinator of the planetarium on campus, which I've also been running since I came on here in 2003. So I do both a lot of outreach as well as the teaching, supervised student research, and my own research, which we'll be talking about here.
Great. Sounds like you stay pretty busy.
Yes.
I've heard it called a pie-eating contest where the reward is more pie.
Yeah.
Can you describe what you study to someone who's maybe not in your field,
the yeah.
brief version for non-astronomers?
So I'm an extragalactic astronomer, so we can take a look at, when an astronomer says the galaxy, we mean the Milky Way galaxy,
right.
Our own galaxy. And so you talk about people who do more galactic work that's within the Milky Way, and that's going to be, it could be anything from stars to supernovas. We don't have too many of those in the Milky Way. Nebulas, dust clouds, or the solar system. And then you have those of us who are extragalactic, and so we're out beyond the Milky Way and generally looking at other galaxies. My specialty is on what are called quasars, more generally active galaxies, which I'll explain in a moment. And then the ways that galaxies evolve over time. So most galaxies have what's called a supermassive black hole. And supermassive is, funny, the technical term for it there. These are black holes which are not just a few times the mass of the Sun. That would be called a stellar mass black hole, one formed from a star blowing up in a supernova. But these are ones which are billions of times the mass of the Sun. And most of those galaxies will, those black holes, will sit there in the galaxy and just mind its own business. Like in our own Milky Way galaxy, which has a supermassive black hole, that's a few million times the Sun's mass. So it's on the low end of those supermassive ones. And it sits there and it doesn't really do much. But in a small number of galaxies, for whatever reasons, that black hole is actively sucking in gas. And as the gas flows in, tends to swirl around in like a giant whirlpool about the size of our solar system. And this kind of a disk, Saturn's ring-shaped disk, with a black hole at the center of it, the inner part of that is orbiting around very quickly from the strong gravity, the outer part more slowly. And as those streams of gas rub up against each other, they produce friction and they get hot. Not just red hot, not even just white hot, but ultraviolet hot and even X-ray hot. And so there are lots of different kinds of active galaxies where the black hole is actively accreting, we would say, gas. But the most powerful of them are the quasars. The trouble is that the light from that, I shouldn't say from the black hole, because the black hole itself doesn't emit light, but from that accretion disk, that whirlpool surrounding the black hole, can be so bright it can outshine the whole galaxy it's in. It can be as bright as maybe 100 Milky Ways in some of the extreme cases. And so you have glare from that tiny pinpoint of light. And even though it may be a billion light years away or more than that in many cases, you can't see the galaxy it's in. You just see that bright glare like a star. So the Hubble Space Telescope was a great benefit because if you were looking at this from the Earth, from the ground, you've got the Earth's atmosphere swirling around here, what we call seeing, which is the twinkling and all the swirling motion of the air, and that blurs out your view. And it's not just blurring it. It makes, if you take a picture of a, say you're looking at a star or a galaxy through the telescope, it'll be jumping up, down, left, and right, second by second, as the air swirls around, because the warm and the cool bands of air then, they bend the light in different ways like a prism. At the same time, it also makes it go in and out of focus. And you can have these changes in fractions of a second time. So it's really tough to do from the ground. That glare would just wash everything out. But if you get up into space, the bright pinpoint of light has a very well-defined pattern. It depends on the telescope you're using. And so the Hubble Space Telescope, there's whole software that's written in order to make a computer model of what that glare looks like. And I wrote some other programs that would help me do all the fits to it. And then you can remove that glare, and you're left with, hopefully, just the galaxy left over. So we learned in the late 90s onto the early 2000s what these galaxies were. Now that a lot of those questions have been answered about quasars, I'm going on to more distant quasars with some of my collaborators. And with other teams I work with, I'm looking at weak versions of quasars called Seyfert galaxies, named after the astronomer Carl Seyfert. And these are, now, these are the real mysterious ones. We found some odd ones that look at, they're low-powered compared to quasars, but a small number of these are emitting gamma rays very strongly. But it's a class of galaxies that shouldn't be emitting gamma rays. And so we're trying to find out what's up with that. We don't know what they're doing. So the trouble is that we don't know what these gamma-ray-emitting galaxies look like. We see just a dot of light. The thing is that those are, for whatever reason, the gamma-ray-emitting Seyfert galaxies are almost all at very great distances. If you've got something which, if you're looking at a star, let's see, the closest star to us is a little over 4 light-years away, Alpha Centauri. If you look at that star, it's about 4 light-years away. You're seeing it the way it used to look 4 years ago, because that's right. How long the light took to get here. All right, now if you look at a galaxy which is 1 million light-years away, in fact, the farthest that you can see with the naked eye, without needing a telescope or binoculars, is the Andromeda Galaxy. And on a good dark night, you can see it pretty well with the naked eye. That galaxy is 2,300,000 light-years away. So that is the farthest thing you can see without a telescope. But it also means you're looking backwards in time over 2 million years. So, and this is a very literal thing. It's not even an analogy. You're seeing it the way it used to look 2 million years ago.
Right.
So these quasars may be 1 billion light-years away or more, quite frequently more. And that means we're looking backwards in time over 1 billion years. Quasars pretty much don't exist anymore. They were an early phase of galaxy evolution, and they've burned out. So the stuff that I started off studying don't even exist now.
Wow.
It's almost like being a paleontologist and digging up fossils. You're studying things that are not even here.
Right.
But we're able to watch them, which is the weird thing. It'd be like watching a movie of dinosaurs roaming around.
Yeah, but not actually having any bones
right,
to look at.
Exactly.
Right.
We can't do laboratory tests on black holes and so on. There are all kinds of OSHA regulations about having those.
Yeah. Might be a little hazardous.
Yes.
What drew you to this research? What got you interested in quasars?
Well, I had almost stumbled into it in a way. When I was in graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh, I had started off doing particle physics. Actually, astronomy was really what my background was at that point. I went to Rhodes College in Memphis, a very small school, 1,400 students. Our department chairman was the former director of the High Altitude Observatory in Boulder, Colorado, and he studies the solar corona. He'd worked on Skylab, for example, back in the 70s, the first space station we had. And he got us studying the solar corona. The department had been chasing eclipses for decades, going all the way back to when all of my professors were students there, and their professor, who was my freshman professor, would take them off on these eclipse expeditions so they could study the sun's corona. I got to graduate school, the astronomy groups there at Pitt, and had a large number of astronomers, just didn't have any openings. And I went into my second interest, which was particle physics.
Mm-hmm.
Working with particle accelerators and detectors. But after a couple of years of that, it was a lot of abstract work. I was doing a lot of calculus and integrals, which is my weak point, to tell you the truth. And I wasn't doing that hot with it. And I didn't get picked up on the research grant, but I used the chance then to then switch over back into astronomy because the astronomers had an opening. And Dave Turncheck, later became the department chairman, had an opening, took me in, and he does quasar work. Well, he does the chemical spectroscopy of quasars. But he said, well, look, there's this, we can get you your grant maybe at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and one of his colleagues there does galaxy imaging, so taking pictures. And between the two of them, they had an idea for a project. It would be looking at the galaxies that quasars are in. And I got the grant, went right on there, spent 3 years at Space Telescope, and it just worked out wonderfully. Just, found my niche.
That's great. And I think that often happens to a lot of us in academia. We have an idea where we're headed, but then other opportunities present themselves,
yep.
Or maybe the one thing you thought you were going to do doesn't quite pan out the way you expected. So,
mm-hmm.
But it's always...
And I wound up with a really nice, broad background.
Yeah.
It felt like having a second liberal arts education just in my field,
yeah.
Because I had to do the subatomic particle physics and all that kind of those kinds of courses, when some of my friends who went straight into what they wanted to do only had narrowly those topics that were for their research. But I wound up with a broader background because I had switched.
Yeah, and I'm sure that helps in all of the research that you do to have that broad background.
Yes, yes. In fact, astronomy is kind of like the liberal arts of the physics world,
right?
Because you do have to know something about almost every field of physics. Everything from like condensed matter even can apply with neutron stars or white dwarfs, all the way up to you're dealing with really heavily theoretical stuff with a lot of math. If you do cosmology,
mm-hmm.
But in a way, I get paid to look at pictures, which is great.
That's not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Not too bad. So let's say that we have students listening who are hearing about your research and they're thinking, this is something I might like to do. How would somebody go about becoming an astronomer?
Okay. The best thing to do is get a major in physics.
Okay.
There are other ways into it. Mathematics, chemistry would be other good ways, and to tell you the truth, in a bit, biology.
I'll
mention that in a minute. You still need a physics background because most of the work will involve physics, but there are other things that can be useful for, like those other areas of science I was mentioning. It is, with anything involving physics, there is a math requirement on that.
Right.
Math was my weakest subject. To the truth, my hardest subject, the one I got the worst grades in. And physics was my second hardest subject. So I'm sympathetic to those who have kind of math anxiety or who struggle with it there. But you can get by with that then. If you can pass that, you can still go through. Going and getting a major in physics or one of these others, and it would be useful in those cases to get a minor in physics because you'll still need the background that those undergraduate courses provide. Then you'd go into graduate school. Some schools have astronomy bundled in with physics in the same department. Other schools have them separated, and it depends on which school it is there. University of Maryland, for example, which is near NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and not too far away from Space Telescope, they've got a separate physics department from the astrophysics department there. And I'll use astronomy and astrophysics pretty much interchangeably. We often joke about what do you call yourself, an astronomer or an astrophysicist? And it depends on if you're on a plane and you'd rather not be bothered or you'd rather start up a conversation with the guy next to you. You choose which one you want to go with. Astronomer will get you a lot of follow-up questions. Astrophysicist people will say, oh, interesting, and pretty much shut up then.
Yeah.
But although half the time someone who doesn't really know the word might mix up astronomer with astrologer.
Oh, no.
To tell you the truth, I've actually had a newspaper interview, I guess one time, where they wrote me up as a local astrologer. But it happens. But... So anyway, that would be the background you'd want. And then what I was meaning with the... you're going to get a graduate degree in that. With a with just a bachelor's degree, you actually could go into the field in some ways. For example, the Space Telescope Science Institute was hiring people pretty much straight out of college for some of the technical support. Mm-hmm. They could be people with a computer science degree. They could be ones maybe with a math degree, but the computer side was useful. Others with a physics degree. And they would be going in on mission planning, observational support and scheduling and so on. And there were a number of people who were in their early 20s right out of college who came in there and are still with them now. Engineering, also another way then, because there is instrument building that goes on. And so they need people with a background on how to actually do the shop work, how to design spacecraft and so on like that. And that's a really exciting way for engineers to get into this. Tell you the truth, I'm kind of a little bit envious because I don't get to play with a spacecraft. And the guys who build that, they get to actually touch these things while they're putting it together. With a master's degree, you've got a higher level of skill, more classwork that you'll do, and maybe a bit more research experience. Some of these places would even pay for people to go on and get a master's degree or even a PhD if they're working there and they just have a bachelor's degree. So that's an opportunity there that you can do later. With a PhD, that's the step forward from the master's to the PhD is that you've got the ability to lead research on your own. And that's really what the extra training in the PhD comes down to. With that, then, that's what, if you want to really be an astronomer, an astrophysicist, as a researcher, that's what you ultimately want to get up to.
So if our listeners would like to learn more about quasars, about black holes, or maybe just about astronomy in general, do you have any recommendations for what they should read, documentaries they should watch, anything like that?
Yes, actually, a lot of the good shows that are on the Science Channel now, and I believe National Geographic Channel, there are several shows. There's one, I think, called The Universe.
Okay.
And which is the one that Morgan Freeman hosts? Okay, Into the Black Hole. I haven't seen that one much. It's been a few years, but my parents have seen that a lot, and mm-hmm. they recommend it. And there are just countless books, mm-hmm. maybe too many to narrow down to any one. But if you go into the physics and astronomy section of any bookstore, you'd find several. Online resources, NASA has, they do a very good amount of public outreach. If you go to the Hubble Space Telescope's website, there's the Space Telescope Science Institute, but they've got a more public-oriented website called Hubble Site, S-I-T-E.
Okay.
I think it's hubblesite.org. And all of the press release photos are put out there, and with a very good write-up on what this picture is actually showing you. Not just what is in this picture, but what's the big picture about it. What kind of a question were the astronomers trying to solve by taking this picture? And it really amazes me to see, since I first got there in the late 90s, which was really only a few years after the Hubble was launched, and even less time than that after the Hubble was fixed and actually got to be a useful telescope. We launched it with a bad mirror.
Mm-hmm.
To see how much better the public outreach has gotten. They have put a lot of work into this, and I know several of the people in that. In fact, the head, at least former head, I don't know if she's still there, Carol Christian, she's also a pilot, an aviation instructor, and a stunt pilot.
Oh, wow.
And several of the people at Space Telescope took lessons from her, including me. I didn't get all the way up to solo wing, but several of the others did. And everybody's got this broad range of interests there. Cool. But anyway, they do fantastic public outreach, and they have really made an art out of making, when the picture comes right off the Hubble,
mm-hmm.
it does not look as great as when it's going to be finally cleaned up.
Right.
You're up in space, you've got all these cosmic rays going through, that's where my particle physics background is useful, these particles from the sun that just really streaks all over the photograph. But we've come up with techniques now for cleaning that up.
Mm-hmm.
And the public outreach guys do a way of cleaning that up and making it look pleasing to the eye as well as scientifically useful. And we've gotten now to be a lot smarter about doing color photos. All the photos are actually black and white, but we put different color filters on them, and then you can combine them to make a color photograph. They do all of that stuff there. And now they've put in these good write-ups that tell you why is this important in answering a certain question. So anyway, go to hubblesite.org for that. You can search by topic, by picture, by latest, and so on. But also at NASA, separate from the Space Telescope Science Institute. NASA's website's a little bit broader in topic, of course, but they have a feature at the Goddard Space Flight Center, where I was a postdoc before I came here, called Ask an Astronomer. And there's somebody, in fact, usually from my old office, who kind of rotates through once a week or once a month, and is a new person is on there and is answering questions from the public on things.
Okay.
And Goddard Space Flight Center and NASA, much more broadly, have done a good job on putting out information at layman level on any topic related to astronomy or space travel. Of course, I've got students who are doing research almost every year with these. Mm-hmm. Even non-physics majors do this. But we are building now a telescope on campus, an observatory on campus. And we've got all the equipment. We're just waiting to get the roof fixed up for it, so it should hopefully go up this year, school year. When that's ready, it will be remotely run over the Internet. So we'll be able to do outreach projects not only from on campus, but also with the surrounding schools. And we'll be able to do projects where they can use the telescope under supervision, and they can just log in from home on their laptops and run the scope or use the data. That's one thing. The Astronomy Club will also get to use that. Another project is we are going to be building a satellite here. So we've got professors from engineering, Ted Kosan, and from business, in fact, Jim Renaud.
Mm-hmm.
The three of us are working together on this. We've already got one grant to start building the ground station, the antennas, and we have found a low-cost space launcher out in California in the Mojave Desert called Interorbital, and they're going to be doing launch operations soon, and they have this kit for a small satellite. It's only a couple of pounds, but it will go into a low-Earth orbit and stay up there for 1 to 4 months. So we're going to put in some sensors that will tell us about the Earth's magnetic field, temperature, solar radiation, and so on. And we will be doing, not only will our Shawnee State students be building it, they'll also be designing it, and we will be doing science projects with it when it's up in space. The Amateur Radio Club on campus will be handling the communications with the spacecraft, and we're also going to be getting the local high schools involved with that too, where they can be doing science projects with it and coming by to see it while we're building it.
All right.
A third thing is that the physics classes that I teach, and occasionally the astronomy classes, we have built an Apollo spaceflight simulator here. And so they get to use it. And so every year we go through this as we teach about spaceflight. And they get to try out roles as astronauts or as flight controllers down in mission control. And the whole class is involved at once, and we've got radios for communicating with the crew, who are off in a separate room. We've got the control panel for the spacecraft. The students learn how to do the maneuvering in space. We go through abort procedures. I occasionally have something blow up on the spacecraft. watch Apollo 13 and then see how this actually worked in real life. Try not to have exactly the same thing happen. And these people really pull together. It's like having a we had a guest speaker who works at NASA, and was telling us on the Apollo program recently, and he said that those mission controllers actually treat themselves and their whole team like a squad of Marines, and that they have life and death decisions they've got to handle there, and they go through really rigorous training. In fact, they do the same kinds of simulations that the students here do.
Oh, wow.
Much more rigorous there.
Yeah.
And so this is another thing, if you're taking physics at Shawnee State, that you get to try out here.
All right. Hear that, people who are looking for a general education course. You take physics at Shawnee State, you get to dabble in the Apollo missions. That sounds like a lot of fun. Great.
That's half of the reason I built it, because I want to play with it.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hamilton. I sure appreciate you coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Great. And we'd also like to thank Dr. Michael Barnhart and the Center for Creative Audio at Shawnee State and the Vern Reif Center. Our podcast producer is Pat Spradlund, with student assistant producer Misty Johnson. This is Dr. Jen Scott. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Research in Progress at Shawnee State University, brought to you by the Teaching and Learning Center. For more information about Shawnee State and the Teaching and Learning Center, visit our website at www.shawnee.edu and search for Teaching and Learning Center.